Welcome to Living Above the Drama. I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio, and today my guest is Greg Katsaftis. He is the author of the book, The Truth About Lies, How Admitting Nothing Could Cost You Everything. Greg has been a career salesperson and entrepreneur and business creator most of his life. He has owned and operated multiple businesses, which generated millions of dollars in revenue. Then, after losing everything, Greg transformed himself into a professional speaker, coach, and criminal justice reform advocate, sharing his message of truth, resilience, and overcoming shame. Greg presents workshops and programs on creating a strong work environment through honesty and vulnerability. He empowers people to look at adversity and mistakes as an opportunity for positive change and growth, leading to increased productivity and a better quality of life. Greg is also the host of Pitching the Truth podcast, writer, and active contributor to multiple blogs, podcasts, and webinars. He also volunteers at Defy Ventures, Project Angel Heart, and is a board member for Tech for Good. Greg, welcome to the show. I'm really delighted to have you on. You have an amazing story, wonderful, although, of course, getting through the process of it wasn't wonderful. But thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you, Georgiana, so much for having me. I greatly appreciate it. I'm looking forward to this.
Absolutely. So let's jump right in here because, your life began, as most of us, have the experience of. You grew up in a normal middle-class family in Littleton, Massachusetts, where your parents still live. And your parents actually were unique in the sense that they had gone to college. They went to college probably during a time where most of us did not have parents who went to college. So tell us about your family, your life. Your mom was a nurse and your dad also worked. And tell us a little bit about your upbringing and your high school experience and what eventually led you to be on this phone call today, because it's really quite a journey.
Well, I had a very positive middle-class upbringing. You know, both my parents did work quite a bit. They were hardworking people, honest people, very simple life. We never went out to eat. Had dinners at home alone with our family all the time, had specific, nights of pizza night every Wednesday. So it was a very simple, loving, caring upbringing with no real drama at all. You know, high school for me was not really eventful. I was an athlete. I succeeded very much in athletics. My grades definitely slowed down a little bit then, but I still got through and I did get accepted to college at University of Lowell up in Massachusetts and attended there for 2.5 years studying engineering. And so overall, my life was pretty average.
Okay. And so you didn't have any major trauma, but what you did receive was a message from your parents, you said during the pre-interview. You received a message that you could do anything. Pretty much you could figure it out. And, you could stand on your own, figure it out, and basically make things happen if you wanted to.
Right, which turned out to be a detriment. I mean, that was definitely, because the parents were working so much and they weren't around as often, I was often told, if I would go request some information or request some help, I'd be told, that's okay, don't worry about it, you'll figure it out. Which, in the end, led me not to ask for any help when things got really bad with me in my business financially, 15 years later. So it was, I didn't realize how much of an impact that had on me until I started writing my book and started really analyzing my life and trying to figure out how I got there, right? How I got to the point where I would just be so dishonest and not pay attention to other people and what was going on around me. So
right,
I think it came back a lot to when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like a Cinderella story. I guess it would be the Prince Charming story in the sense that you were a big fish in a little pond in high school. You excelled in sports. You were popular. You were a good student. You got accepted to college. And then you left to to go on your sales path, and you were working in the field of, I guess, purchasing and distributing alcoholic products, and you did that for quite some time, and you did very well in business. You always worked hard, and you said that you were an overachiever, that that was how you would describe yourself, with as an overachiever. So here you are working away, you know, you're kind of like, you're in your heyday there, you know, things are going really, really well. And you, after a, I guess, a disappointing heartbreak, you wound up meeting your wife and getting married and having children. So tell us about that little journey, you know, how you went and started your family, have a beautiful home, doing very well, which was the prelude to the problem that happened afterwards.
Yes, that's true. So, yes, I mean, I moved to Colorado with Robin, who I was very thankful that she brought me here. We're still friends to this day. She still lives in Boulder, Colorado, which I think is amazing. But, you know, then after we broke up, we just kind of faded, our relationship faded away. It wasn't anything harsh. You know, I met my wife, soon-to-be wife, Amy, and, you know, she was younger than I was. I was obviously a little bit lost because I'm in Colorado with no family, so we quickly kind of connected with each other, and I was running a small car dealership at the time, and her father helped me with a little bit of a loan, $10,000, to keep things going and get started, and from there, I just worked really, really hard to build that business from the $10,000 investment over the course of, well, that was 1998 to 2006, where my sales peaked just over $10 million for that year. So we built a couple houses, three to be exact, over the course of that time, until we ended up in a very nice house in a neighborhood in Boulder that's pretty desirable up against the mountain. The house is about a $2 million home. I had a massive mortgage. I had a new car dealership with, again, a massive mortgage, but I was making a lot of money at the time, so it seemed like everything was okay and everything was going to be fine. Well, but I was definitely living well beyond my means, for sure.
Yeah, well, I want to interject because I think that you will totally resonate with this. You were doing that at a time where it seems the banks were pushing. They were happy to loan money to people. They were pushing money at people. They wanted you to take the big loans. They wanted to make the big interest. This was what was going on at that time. And they were loaning money to people to buy houses and to open businesses that should never have been loaned that kind of money. The home equity situation at that point, people would have a house that was, let's just say, worth $500,000. They would loan them up to $1 million on that house. So it was kind of a setup for you, wasn't it? In a sense, I mean, you know, it was like ambition, and you had three children at the time. I mean, you still do, but you had three children, right, that you were raising and supporting. Yes.
Yes, exactly. And it was, you know, it's funny you bring that up because I had a banker that I did almost all my business with, and I was thinking about buying this lot of land to build this car dealership. And at the time, you know, things were fine because I had a small little location I had a really good lease on to run my business out of, and the overhead was really low, so I was making more money. And he showed up at my door like one day, and he's like, "So I heard you're looking at this land," and it turns out the realtor had called him. He's like, "You know, I can put together an SBA loan and blah, 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 blah." And he's like, "Won't be an issue." So that's exactly what happened. I got, you know, a lot of different things showed up and presented themselves that kind of led to this whole snowball effect that caused me to think I can just keep making more money. Everything's going to be great. And of course, we all know what happens when the economy crashed in 2008. I was nowhere near prepared.
That was the trick. The trick was that I think the banks always knew when the bottom fell out of all of those, that bundling and that, you know, over projection and overspending and all that kind of greed motivated financing that was going on, they knew they wouldn't be touched. They knew it wasn't, you know, one or two of them maybe wound up with a little boo-boo, but who really paid the bill on that? Who really got stuck? It was people like you and hardworking people, business owners mostly, honestly, and a lot of homeowners who got nailed to the wall. So with that little comment, tell us what happened to you, because it's really, I would call it the American tragedy. It's like the story of like how we lose our way and how we're lured into doing things we might never even consider doing and might never want to do. But there's this sense of, if we don't do it, what will happen? What will we lose? There's a lot of fear behind it. So tell us about, you know, your American tragedy story, because it really is one. It really is, if you think about it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was, again, things were going fine. Then 2008 happens, and I've got all kinds of advice to just close my doors and file bankruptcy after not selling anything for 60 days, which is really unusual. I mean, I was selling 50 to 60 cars a month. I had a service department and everything just stopped. And I couldn't, by then I was so, I guess, allured or, you know, almost just intoxicated by the idea of how much money I was making before that I never thought that I could just close my doors. I thought I could just keep going, you know, just figure it out, Greg, and keep moving forward, which is what I did. And things just got progressively worse, and I fell farther and farther behind. Then it started spilling into not being able to pay people for their cars, checks being returned, you know, which caused a lot of harm and damage to multiple people, until eventually I just couldn't sustain it. I had to sell. I short sold my building, okay, that building that I built with that big massive loan from that banker. I had to short sell it at a $500,000 loss. So I had to move my business to another location, which was not a good location. But I struggled there for a year. Then I moved again. And then by then, things were just, you know, not going well at all. And that's when some people complained that they weren't getting paid to the district attorney in Boulder. And eventually I got arrested and charged with theft. So, you know, I just completely lost my way and my sense of reality as to how many people were being affected by my actions. And I think that's really what people need to understand, is that all of a sudden things can seem like they're going great, but then in the end, they're not.
Right. Well, doesn't that raise the whole question for all of us, Greg, about moral compass? What is our moral compass and how we get seduced? We all get seduced at some point or another. It can be related to anything. It doesn't have to be related to money. It doesn't have to be related to work. It can be related to relationships or the way we treat our family or so many things. So don't you think for you that this was kind of a, you know, that you've heard the expression come to Jesus moment, you know, where you, you know, your back's against the wall and you really got to take a look at yourself and say, wow, how did that happen to me?
Well, the minute I hit my first jail cell, that's exactly what happened. In Boulder County Jail, I looked around. You know, the shock of what happened, right? And at that time, I think I'm going to be in prison for 6 years. And, you know, the whole shock of the courtroom, which was gut-wrenching because, you know, people are crying, people are angry, you know, victims are angry on one side, my family's crying on the other, and not going back to see my children, not knowing when I'm going to get back to them. And I just immediately started looking at it, like, you know, what did you do? Like, how did you do this to all these people? And now, what's the most important thing? What are you going to do? And that, to me, that was very simple. I had to get out of there as soon as I possibly could to get back to my family, get back to my kids, and begin paying people back. So I started writing. I wrote a bunch of letters literally that first night, apologizing to family members about, you know, the shame and disgrace I'd put them through. And I kind of tried to quickly write my moral compass, because obviously before that, I just didn't realize how important it was to have that kind of ethical direction.
Wow. So that was a real, real wake up call, going from a very affluent and a very enjoyable environment, your family, your community, and your business, to opening up your eyes. And there you are in the jail cell. What a trauma. So immediately it started to hit you. I have got to do something. And I love the title of your book. When we were talking at the pre-interview, I said to you, the title of a book is absolutely critical. And you hit it. You nailed it, Greg. The truth about lies. The truth about lies. You know, Because lies, unfortunately, and I don't want to get political about this, but the lies in our culture are becoming a more normal means of getting what you want, to lie and to move away from what we know is really healthy and really respectful for ourselves and other people. And your subtitle, How Admitting Nothing Could Cost You Everything. Let's talk about that for a little bit, and then we're going to take a break. We're going to take a commercial break. But that not admitting, not being able to ask for help, not being able to go and tell someone what you were going through. What did you learn about that during this terrible period of time? What would you say to people, especially, and I say especially men, and I know that probably sounds a little sexist, but the thing is, I think women have a tendency, you know, we go to our girlfriends. That's kind of something that we do. I think men have a tendency to kind of open up less. So what did it teach you in that, you know, particular time in your life about going for help and opening up and admitting and talking to others?
Well, I mean, I never nurtured relationships and friendships when I was working, right? I just worked and I made a lot of money. I had business relationships that I thought were friendships, but I never had that strong connection, those people that I thought I could really trust to share this information with. And that, I think, is really lacking. And I agree with you very much with men that they don't confide with each other because we're supposed to be strong. We're supposed to be figuring everything out on our own. We're supposed to be, you know, driven, successful, a father, a leader. And I certainly was in that same mix. But I think what people don't get nowadays, and again, I agree with you not to get political, but, you know, you see these people going about their ways and getting away with it over and over and over again. And that's great because maybe they'll succeed, maybe they won't. But the average person doesn't really realize the consequences of even the smallest lie, even the smallest indiscretion, how that can affect not only their life, but the life of the person they're talking to. And that's something I just didn't get. And now I do get, because even some words that I could say that could be harmful or hurtful to somebody, I really step back and try to really focus on the fact, like, okay, make sure you're paying attention to what they're going through. And, you know, with the certain group of friends that I have now, I have four really strong male friends that are obviously, they were with me through this whole process and everything that happened. And they hold me accountable now for anything that they think I may or may not be doing correctly. They help me with my job and other things that I'm trying to accomplish by paying my restitution back. But it's refreshing to have somebody across the table when you say, hey, I'm thinking about doing this or I'm considering that, and have them look at you and give you a very straight answer, which is not something I had early on. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really lacking. I think people just being really, really honest, I think, is something we need to improve upon for sure.
So what you learned is that the healthy interdependence that we have with each other as human beings and our personal integrity are really very important elements to what makes a happy and healthy life. And isn't that an amazing lesson? Isn't that a hard way to learn that lesson? Greg, we're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, maybe you could talk to us more about your personal kind of internal spiritual psychological journey, because I'm sure that it took you a while to clear out the cobwebs and forgive yourself. I mean, the worst of it is, you talked about the shame. So let's talk about the shame when we come back, because many, many people experience shame for many reasons. And maybe we can talk about, you know, sometimes why we feel shame from the things that we choose to do. Don't go away, listeners. We will be back in just a few moments with Greg Kostaftis. The first time I said your name, I got it right. And now, but it's Kostaftis, right? I got it right again. So we will be back. We will be back. Don't go anywhere.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment in our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
Today I'm talking with Greg Kostaftis. Greg is the author of The Truth About Lies, How Admitting Nothing Could Cost You Everything. Before the break, we were talking about Greg's journey, which has been quite remarkable, that led him to some very sad and somewhat tragic events, to have the opportunity to examine his own choices, his own behavior, and as a result of those choices and behavior, Greg experienced a great deal of pain and a great deal of shame. So, Greg, before the break, I asked if you would share with us. This is a big deal, kind of, in a lot of people's lives. Feeling shame, feeling, you know, it was funny. I had spoken with someone from AA not long ago. We were talking, and we were talking about, like, you know, some of the qualities that alcoholics share. And what he said is the biggest one is this terrible sense of being totally unworthy, of having no value and being completely ashamed. So can you talk to us about that?
Sure. sorry, I got a little cold this morning. So I've struggled quite a bit with, you know, the criminal past thing, having that around your neck and having that in your mind, all the people that you've hurt and all the things you've done. It's been very, very difficult to kind of step past, just to get my head around the idea that, you know, I'm a worthy person again. And this, you know, this spins into a lot of different angles. You know, the shame obviously within myself has been the hardest part, but you know, throughout the supervision through the whole criminal justice system, you're basically looked upon and literally talked to that you're, you know, a piece of crap. And you know, I was told point blank at one time, you know, you're wired differently, you're never going to change, this is who you are, you were born this way. And these were the exact words that was said to me by my probation officer. So I quickly realized, like, okay, I know I'm not that person, but what am I going to do to change that to make sure people understand and I feel better about myself? So I got heavily into meditation, prayer, journaling, writing, anything I could do that made me feel a little bit more worthy, like I was trying to help people. that was what I really tried to focus on. And it really changed my mind and shifted how I felt about myself and helped to my shame to kind of subside. It's still there because I don't think it'll ever really go away, but it's driven me to really try to do better things to help others in order to, you know, help them not make the same mistake.
So was the underlying message that you experienced was that everyone is worthy. Everyone deserves respect and to be treated with kindness and to be treated with integrity. Is that, I mean, it sounds like the bottom line is you connected the dots that all human beings, we all want to be treated the same way. We all deserve to be treated the same way. And that it's really, when we go off the rails and we feel better than other people and we treat them differently from us and we treat them as less than, when other people become less than and we become more than, I talk about this a lot on my show. Cancer is when rogue cells decide that they're more important and they literally want all the nutrition. They want to break into all the other cells and take all of their resources and the cancer cells, they have no purpose other than to kind of make themselves fat and plump and healthy, cancer cells, but they don't contribute to the function of the body in any way. And isn't that what we do? And is that something you kind of got in touch with?
It is. I don't look upon, you're right. I mean, I was, to use your analogy, definitely was the cancer cell at one point in my life where I would just take and grab whatever I could. Now, I mean, there's not one person that I don't look at that I don't have empathy for, you know, no matter who they are, or, you know, sympathy to try to understand what they're going through. And never in my mind will I ever be like, oh, I'm better than that person. That doesn't resonate with me at all anymore, because I agree with you. We've all made mistakes, you know, and I talk a lot about this in my speeches and my writing, that everybody's got something they're shameful for. It's just the hardest part is being able to step through the door, you know, I call it the door of shame, into the other world, because you're so nervous that everybody else is going to look upon you and they're going to judge you and they're going to think they're better than you are because you made this huge mistake. This is how I feel. But the reality is, if everybody embraced it and everybody was a little bit like more understanding and kind of forgiving and said, yes, you know, we're not going to say that you didn't make a mistake. You did, and you hurt a lot of people, but you know, we see that you're trying to better yourself and you're trying to be a better human being and trying to help others, that therefore we're going to accept you. Can you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. What you're talking about is there's a wonderful book called Love is Letting Go of Fear. It's written by a medical doctor. It's just a marvelous book. And what he basically says is, look, this is how it operates. We're either coming from competition, which is driven by fear. And so we're coming from a fear-based thing, and it's all about kind of us. Or we're coming from, there are two things that people come from. This is how human beings operate. And it's funny because I have recommended this book to more people. It's actually quite popular with 12-step programs. It's called Love is Letting Go of Fear by Gerald Jampolsky, MD. And it takes a look at why is it that we treat each other the way we do? It's really fear-driven. It's fear mm-hmm. that, you know, there isn't enough and I need to get what I need to get for me. And if I don't get it, you know, then somebody else will take it. We see things from a scarcity perspective. And what you're saying is, why can't we be nice to one another? You know, like, why can't we be loving? What is this? Like, why can't you see that a person is doing their best and working hard and overcoming their mistakes? Why do we have to kick them when we're down, when they're down, right?
Right. And, you know, and my personal experience is I've got some really positive influences in my life. I mean, there's been plenty of times where it's gotten really dark, you know, really dark and depressing in my world, you know, and it's usually when you're kind of alone and there's no one around that's willing to even to listen to you or even, you know, consider that you're a good person. It's taken a long time for that. And I think you're right that if people are more accepting and more generous and more positive, okay, just to help people move forward after some mistake or some tragedy or whatever they're going through, everybody would be much more successful, much happier. And I don't think people realize the power of how it feels to help somebody else like that. Like, I've really recognized when I really reach out and give of my time, such as in volunteering or some of the nonprofit work I do, it's really satisfying in a sense that it's nice to see that you're helping somebody and watch them open up a little bit, because they're not used to seeing that. They're not used to people being so kind to them.
Yeah. And the catch to this is that we have to be able to love and respect ourselves before we can love and respect other people. And this is where, you know, looking at you said something that was really very interesting. And I think that, you know, this is echoed in some of the best literature out there. You said no one accomplishes anything by themselves. No man is an island. No woman is an island. We cannot just isolate ourselves. We cannot be so protective and so concerned about our welfare and that we may not get ours, that what we do is we separate from other people, because not only is it physically dangerous, we know that, you know, animals and even humans in our world, we need each other. We need that for protection, for insulation, for belonging. So what you were saying is, I think from the overall discussion that we had, is that you realized that you had to change how you saw the world. It was no longer everybody's competition, or it's all dangerous out there and I've got to, you know, watch my back and all of that. You changed to a more open-hearted approach. Would you say that that is true?
Yes, I realized the value of community, and that was something that I was completely lacking before. And now, just, you know, it's not about making money. It's not about succeeding or being the best, I don't know, whatever you want to say, salesperson or the best person in your community as far as finances go. For me, it's really about what communities am I a part of? How am I benefiting that community? How am I helping others in that community? That's what's really important to me personally. And
right.
it took me a long time to learn it, but it's like what you're talking about. Way back in the day, you know, if you were way back in the day, I'm talking like the Stone Age, if you're a person by yourself, there's no way you could survive. You had to have other people around. You had to have
exactly.
a group, a tribe. And I really
and
value my
do.
Tribe,
we,
for sure.
We really still do, don't we? I mean, when you see a homeless person, I lived in New York for many, 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 many years, and when you interact, and I used to interact with homeless people, and when you are in that relationship and you're interacting with that person, what you realize is the worst part of their life is that they're isolated, they're alone. There's no one else there with them. And so in a sense, your journey, excuse me, it's really been a gift to you. When you're lecturing and speaking now and you've written a book, so let's talk about how you're translating your experiences and this wonderful wisdom and humility that you've experienced. How are you translating that to help other people?
No, I'm translating. I'm talking a lot about the importance of truth and accountability. And I'm talking a lot about how it's important to have a group of people that hold you accountable so that your actions will lead forward to helping overcome your own shame from your own mistakes, and also trying to help other people, again, reach through that door and tell them it's okay to come in here. We're not going to jump on you. We're not going to ambush you. We're going to try to help you, and just get people to be a little bit more open about their struggles. You know, and this transcends to, you know, relationships, people in general, businesses. I think a lot of people are really hiding behind the facts and creating a little bit of a mystique, if you will, a kind of an image that's not really reality, because they're afraid about being hurt. And I think it's important that, and I talk about this a lot in my book, about being more open, being more honest, and being more direct.
Right. And doesn't that stem from fear of rejection?
Yes.
Let's face it, the worst thing that any of us can experience is rejection. And again, we can become more aware. See, you went from a fear-based behavioral life to a love-based behavioral life. I mean, it's very clear in your case, you know, that fear drove you to get to where you got. And now love, self-love and love for others is also driving you to have a different kind of connection and a different kind of relationship. So when you're speaking to people, what is their reaction? I mean, I know we're kind of being conditioned at this point over the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years to mm-hmm. lie, to cheat, and to steal. I mean, our culture has been, that's how we've gotten into so much, you know, political and financial problems over the last 30 years, to lie, cheat, and steal. So here you are, you're presenting this information, and you're not doing it in a 12-step program, and you're not doing it, you know, as evangelical. So how are people reacting to your experience?
It's tough. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, they react in a very positive way, and they appear to get it. They appear to understand it, but I don't know how many people actually implement it. I think that's the hardest part, because it's such a culture of exaggeration. You know, there's a lot of white lies, kind of vague gray truths, I think, out there right now. So people get the concept of what I'm talking about when they look at me, and they, you know, a lot of people look at what happened to me and they're like, well, there's no way that happened. You couldn't have gone to jail for that. And I'm like, well, no, I did. And then I explain the whole story, and they still don't get it because they don't understand the consequences of it. So I think that's what's really been eye-opening for me, is having people look at me and be like, just with disbelief. And then when I start nailing back all the points as to what happened and why, and what I've learned from it, and what my message is, that if we were all a little bit more honest and direct, somebody would have reached out to me. If I had really confessed how financially screwed I was, to specifically to some of the people that I was closest to then, I think they would have helped me. Now, they would have tried to help me. Would I have listened? Maybe, maybe not, because my ego is so big. But at the time, even to have somebody recognize it and try to step in might have been just enough to kick me over to stop and figure out a better solution rather than what happened to me. That's what gets people's attention, when they really realize, like, okay, maybe if I adjust just a little bit and I take some advice or I ask for help, I can save myself a lot of pain and suffering.
Well, you also said something very interesting during the pre-interview. You said you didn't really have the right people around you. And so what that speaks to is how our consciousness kind of puts us in an environment with other people of kind of the same thinking. Because in a sense, the people that you were comfortable with and the people that you interacted with were people who kind of shared the same approach, the same fear-based approach to life. So you didn't want to expose yourself, and they were not of the ilk that would reach out to you or ask you how you were doing. What was going on with your parents during this whole time? You kind of talked about that a little bit. I mean, you didn't feel that that was something that you could discuss with them. You want to just talk a little bit about that, Greg? Because that's kind of
I'm oldest child. that's what it, I mean, oldest child, you'll figure it out. I've always been successful. So it wasn't in my mindset to be like, hey, mom and dad, I'm kind of stuck here. And, you know, they had never been in business. They'd never done anything like this, and I didn't trust that they would give me any solid advice. Now, I wasn't really honest to say, hey, I'm in financial chaos right now. People aren't getting paid. You know, checks aren't being cashed. And I think they may have woken up a little bit more and listened to me, but I didn't feel that we had that level of relationship, which is, you know, I guess a little bit on them. I'm really making corrections right now with my three daughters to be very adamant in how I talk to them, and especially how they handle themselves and they manage their money. That's become something I'm very, very focused on. But you're right. I didn't have the parents were never something that I thought I could kind of confide in. And I didn't, like, obviously confided in them once everything happened, but they were just shocked. Like, they had no, how could this happen? It was that kind of their response.
Oh, I can imagine. So is your relationship with your parents now much better?
You know, my parents never wavered. They were loving, kind, forgiving from day one. I mean, they were not happy. Okay, I'm not going to say that they were just pushed layover, but they were, especially my mother, has been my rock for pretty much my whole life. You know, she's always been there, very faithful, religious person, and she's, you know, made sure that everything's good. At the same time, trying to bring me back to accountability has been something that she's been very focused on as well.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, your life has gotten a lot better, really, than it was before.
I have a whole chapter in the book called The Gift of Time Served. You know, mm-hmm. I quickly, mm-hmm. when I got to my final facility, you know, you progress through two or three places until you end up to the place where you're going to spend most of your time. You know, I created a pattern of, as I've said, meditation every morning, prayer every morning, reading, like read all these books and learned from other people. And I will get the book that you mentioned, of course, today. And I just really spent all this time trying to work on myself. And after I came out, as much as the whole situation really sucked, right? It was difficult. It was hard. You're absolutely right. Because if I had, say, it somehow somebody had lent me some money and kind of saved me and my business, I didn't get arrested and I was still in the car industry and still doing that work, or maybe still married to my ex-wife and hadn't learned all the lessons that I've learned about human nature and being empathetic and being a better person, I would never trade one for the other. I'm much happier now with who I am as a person and the things I've learned through this adversity than if I had stayed doing what I was doing before, mm-hmm. for sure.
All right. Well, when we come back, we have to take our next and final break. But when we come back, you talked in the pre-interview about more accountability. And I want to say this as a mother of three millennial children. One of the things that I think we did wrong, my generation raising our children, and I don't know what you think about this, but we were focusing on helping them and we weren't focusing on making them accountable in the sense that everybody had to get a trophy. Everybody had to win. We didn't want anybody to feel, you know, struggle or pain or any of the things that most of us feel as human beings in our life. And so accountability is a tremendous subject, and we could talk about it from many perspectives. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk about your book, where people can get it, and how they can connect with you, Greg, and have you share your story with them more intimately. Don't go away, anybody. We will be back in just...
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
We are back. We are speaking today with Greg Katsaftis. Greg is the author of the book with a fabulous title, The Truth About Lies, How Admitting Nothing Could Cost You Everything. Greg, you didn't admit anything, and it cost you everything.
That's true.
And you talk about white lies and gray truth. What a great sentence that is, too. That's another book. That's your next book, right?
Could be. That's right.
Let's talk about accountability, because I don't think most of us, I know when I was raising my kids, I didn't think of allowing them to suffer the consequences of their kind of evolution as a human being, that was a good thing. I thought maybe this is a mom thing, or maybe this is just my generation. I thought that was unacceptable. My children should not suffer. We had to, insulate them from the pain of life. Let's talk about accountability. Now that, obviously, that was the first major time that you were held accountable on a very deep level for your choices and your behavior. What do you say to your daughters? What do you say to the people who you are sharing your life with at this point? How do you talk about accountability?
Well, it's been interesting for all of my children. They're all great students. They're very successful. They're very driven. And I haven't, because of what happened to me, I think it really woke them up. It woke them up to the idea that, first of all, obviously I'm a human being and I made big mistakes, but also I think it made them realize that they have to you have to be accountable. You have to be honest at all times because, you know, look what happened to Dad, right? So it's a little bit easier for me from that standpoint, but I think you're right. I think people need to have the ability to fail a little bit, but at the same time, you can't give them everything. And my children, up until the point of when I went away, they were given pretty much everything. I mean, you know, private school, the, you know, beautiful house, great neighborhood, the whole thing. They didn't really want for anything. And quickly, once I was gone and my ex-wife had to move to a rental house and shuffle around and take care of all of them, their life changed drastically. And they realized the importance of, you know, the account, what happened to me and how my lack of accountability made everything go away. So they had some adversity they had to struggle through, and I think it's really helped them. So it's a fine line. I definitely did not get enough guidance when I was a child, and I was left to, you know, hold myself accountable, which didn't work. And at the same time, I think if somebody had given me a little more direction, kind of in between, it would have been, I would have probably had a different outcome.
Right. It's as if our work in the world, I've seen it, I'm sure you've seen it, our work, how we identify ourselves through what we do in the world, you know, how people see us. This seems to be a focus point for so many of us that becomes the big enchilada, you know, like my job and my success and, you know, the neighborhood I'm living in. And I think it's across the board. It just seems to be that it's very much an enculturated attitude that we have, and mm-hmm. that other cultures, other societies don't necessarily, although some are worse than us, you know, there are societies where children will commit suicide if they don't get into the right preschool. I mean, you know, you hear this stuff, you read this stuff, and it's crazy. So it appears that what we need to take a look at is how we serve ourselves and other people in this world outside of the work we do, but how we interact with each other as human beings. What do we bring to the table? And from what you've said, for you, it has been such a major wake-up call to be kind, to help other people. So when you're doing your lectures and you're speaking to people, what's the main topics that they want to talk about? When they hear your story, people must have burning questions so that they don't, you know, go down the same rabbit hole. What are the big questions that you get?
People want to know what it was like, how difficult was it to overcome the shame and overcome the adversity of what happened. People want to know how I was ever able to get to the point of being so delusional and lying so often. That's another common question. And they really want to know the structure. And what I'm really, really focused on is the structure of what I've done to come back and the importance of what you're talking about. Like, you know, even volunteering, just the quality of people that I've met there and the connections I've made in regards to business and speaking and how it's spilled into my whole life, it's changed the whole energy around me. In other words, mm-hmm. you know, I'm attracting higher quality people because I'm spending so much time with higher quality people and giving of my time and giving of myself to them, and then they reciprocate to me. That's the thing I think people don't get. You know, you really touched on something when you said, you talked about people's identity as their job. You know, I grew up in Massachusetts, and I know you're there as well, and that was always, that's like the main thing, like, you know, what's going on? Oh, work is this. Oh, work is that. You know, they don't really get that. They think that's their identity and that's what they have to be doing at all times, succeeding and winning. But they don't realize, you know, when people ask me what's going on, I say, oh, I had a great meeting with, yesterday I met with a felon who just got out of prison after being in there for 24 years. And it was the most incredible conversation we had for an hour yesterday at coffee. That's what I'll talk about. I don't want to talk about my job or success or anything like that. I try to talk about things that are more interesting. And I think people don't realize the value of that kind of connection. So that's what I get asked a lot.
Well, I love that you raised the idea of high quality people. Because what's interesting is when we really look at that, you know, you can think of high quality people as the person driving, you know, the Mercedes, or you can think of high quality people as a person who thinks and feels and lives at a level of integrity that is not only enriching to themselves, but enriching to those of us who are around them. And I think that this is what changes the dialogue. Your dialogue has changed. Your worldview has changed because you experienced what we talk about, low quality and high quality. Low quality is self-absorbed, self-serving, you know, giving to the self, the concern for what we get and me and my and ours. And when you look at what is a high quality person, it's a person who sees the big picture, who sees the interconnectedness of all of us to each other and realizes that to do harm to another person is to really do terrible harm to yourself. Because mm-hmm. to have that kind of intent to take from another, you know, to lessen another, to increase who we are, you know, this is what's up on the planet now. I think that, you know, this is the big picture of what we're all being invited to take a look at. You know, what is our intention? What are we doing? How are we living our life? And you are a young guy and you still have a lot of life ahead of you and a lot to share and a lot to really provide people knowledge from your very painful but very deeply enriching experience. Where can people get a hold of you, Greg? I mean, how can they hear your podcast? I mean, you have your own podcast that you do. Tell us about that and how people can, you know, get a hold of you, how they can hear about you, get the book, et cetera.
Okay, well, my podcast is called Pitching the Truth. It's on Amazon. Sorry, it starts on Stitcher, iTunes, you know, all various, I don't know how many channels we're on, but quite a few. It's pretty easy to find if you just Google Pitching the Truth. I've written a book, The Truth About Lies, as you know, How Admitting Nothing Can Cost You Everything. That is on Amazon, very easy to find, and appreciate anybody that wants to take a look at that. I also want to emphasize that every penny of profit from that book goes back to my victims. I don't take any money from that. I just cover the cost of whatever it is that Amazon charges me to publish and send the book out, and the rest of the profit goes towards my victims to get them paid. I have a webpage. It's called veracitygp.com. You can reach me there, greg@veracitygp.com. I'm on Instagram under GPK_truth, Facebook under Gregory Paul, and also Pitching the Truth has its own Facebook page as well. And what else? Twitter,
okay.
On there as
so
well.
People,
a little bit, so.
People just have to know how to spell your name, which is Greg with one G, right? And
correct.
Your last name is Kotsaftis. So it's Kotsaftis. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny because your tongue kind of trips over that a little bit. But, Greg, it has been just a pleasure having you on. I mean, I so appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners deeply appreciate you sharing. This is a tough thing. This is a tough thing because in the back of your mind, you're going, oh, God, everybody thinks I was a dirtbag. I was a dirtbag. You know, I was this bad guy, and I did these bad things. And yet, out of your courage, and I congratulate you on your courage to face the truth, to tell the truth, and to rise above it. You know, we all fall, but to have the strength and to have the courage to rise above it, you should really allow yourself to give yourself a big hug and know that, you know, you are a wonderful role model for many of us, and those of us who hear this story are moved and touched, and you know, we're never the same when we hear a good story like this. So thank you for coming back and rising above and, you know, taking a different path, and for sharing all of that with us, Greg.
No, I greatly appreciate you having me on, and yes, it's, you know, as I say often, and it's been said quite a bit, if I can get one person to make a decision in the right direction and not make the same mistake to whatever level that is off of what I did, then it's worth it. And, you know, I can't look back. Yes, I made a lot of mistakes, but all I can do is continue to do good things and move forward. And that's what I try to do every day. But I greatly appreciate you having me on. It was fun. It was awesome.
Well, thank you. And listeners, don't forget to join us again next week when we have another inspiring, uplifting, and very, very informative interview on Living Above the Drama.